it's kind of a rare moment when a cabinet secretary opens up about his mother's alcoholism and drug abuse. And that's one of the things you're going to hear this week when we delve into the Obama administration's efforts to fight rural poverty. And then we take a look at the business of addiction recovery and how it's changing Florida. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. My interview with Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack is later in the show. Plus, we've got stories about how big companies are shifting more and more of their business to mobile. Even, seriously, skincare and makeup are getting tech-inspired. And probably my favorite Marketplace quiz we've ever done with Samantha Bee. It's, well, you just have to listen. Come share your thoughts on the show. Reach out to us at marketplace.org, on Marketplace's Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We're starting the show today with a bit of a pun, or a play on words, I guess. This is a leap year, so we asked about your economic leaps, starting a business, getting fired even. And while, yes, leaps can be stressful, they also create opportunities. Gwynne Bird from Sacramento left a job as an attorney after a series of life-changing events.
About 12 years ago, I had about three major life events occur for me. One was giving birth to twins, one was turning 40, and the other is that my mother passed away. And that for me was a big life transition that got me thinking about what do I want to do with the rest of my life. I had been a career woman up until then and decided, is this all there is to life and should I be doing something else?
And I gather you started your own business, huh?
I did. I started a self-inventory and was thinking about what am I good at? What do I enjoy? What brings me pleasure? What skill sets do I have? And that all led me to becoming a professional home organizer. And so it was a lot of kind of soul searching about what does this mean and is this okay and how am I going to do this? But so it was about a two-year transition period for me to really say that it was okay. And I gave myself a deadline and I said, okay, you're doing this or you're not. And so I just decided to go forward.
When did you realize that you could make it work financially?
Honestly, not till about 5 years in. You know, it was always one of those, is this just a hobby or is this something that's really going to work as a career? For several years, we were sort of guessing. But but now I'm at a place where it's a completely wonderful work-life balance, and I just love it.
Gwynne Bird, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for asking.
Alan Patrick in Holt, Michigan, took what he calls a leap of faith. He merged his hobbies with his economic life by becoming a partner in his friend's gaming store.
I was a restaurant developer for a long time, and I wandered the country and opened stores all over the place, and eventually decided I'd had enough of living in hotels, and I moved back to home here in Michigan after traveling all over. And I found that an old friend of mine had recently opened a game store in the small village that I grew up in. And the village has full-time residents of maybe 2,200 people.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, exactly. The game market isn't a super profitable thing. Not a whole lot of folks retire from there, if you know what I mean. And over time, over the course of the last 5 years, we've both realized that by taking a leap and going for something completely unexpected and off the wall, we're actually building out our own dreams and our own community goals by offering a safe, inclusive environment for people of all walks of life to show up and plop down in a seat and meet new friends that maybe they didn't know that they would keep friends with before they walked through the door.
We've heard from people who started their own small business or changed fields to go after something they already loved. Your story is a little bit different because it seems like it's not necessarily about pursuing entrepreneurship, but finding balance in another part of your life and letting that flower?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. The longer I'm with this, the more I realize that I want to ensure that other people have these social outlets that don't necessarily exist in modern American culture anymore. We pretend to have social interactions, but by encouraging people in and bringing them in and sitting them down and putting a pile of dice in front of them, we find that it's changed the overall atmosphere of the folks that come through the door.
Alan Patrick, thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you.
And at 63, Marty Hagen in Las Vegas lost her job and, yes, leapt into a new one.
I had been an interior designer for over 33 years, and lost my home during the Las Vegas downtrend and went to a school for a short time of about 6 years, Le Cordon Bleu, thinking I could change careers. And they closed that school. And a month ago, I found myself at 63 without a job and looking for answers. And late night, around 11 o'clock, online looking for a job, a wedding chapel, wedding planner opening came up. Next thing I know, I found out I'm taking a leap of faith into a career that might be the most rewarding thus far before retirement.
What's it like at the wedding chapel?
It's a lot of fun, as you can imagine. In Las Vegas, the characters and people that come to visit are from all over the world, and it's inspiring. I'm divorced myself, but believe it or not, after only a week on the job, I have hope and faith again.
Really?
I do, in an odd sort of way. There are people from 21 to 90 still getting married today and renewing vows and commitment ceremonies. I feel promise now.
Well, Marty Hagen, thank you very much for talking with me.
Well, I hope that I can inspire someone to never give up, no matter what your age. And I think this job is going to afford me to just sleep a little bit better at night, because I'm not only helping others, I'm helping myself, and it sure feels good.
Thank you to everyone who wrote us and left us voicemails about your leaps. Next week, we want to hear your stories of financial recovery. Maybe it's a bounce back from the Great Recession, or it's about addiction. Whatever it took to recover and keep going, let us know by going to Marketplace.org or Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. Finance can have a lot of jargon. Most of it is not all that helpful. But the terms long and short can be. Long for betting on something, like a stock. Short for betting against it. We do that here with news stories, topics, and trends we are positive and negative about. This week, we've got Marketplace producer Raghu Manavalan and reporter Tracy Samuelson. Hi, guys.
Hey, Lizzie.
Hey, how's it going?
All right, Raghu, since Tracy is in this room with me, you're in our studio in LA, I'm letting you go first. What are you long?
I'm going to go long. I'm sure you guys saw this. Facebook's new reaction buttons. They're like the, I believe, five extra little emoji smiley faces that you might have noticed. No one is using them from what I can tell, which is why it makes for a weird long. But I'm just impressed by Facebook's ability to keep figuring out ways to steal data from us. Now we have an angry button. We have a sad button. We have a love button.
Yeah. Well, so wait a minute. You're a millennial, so I don't expect you to use this stuff. Because, like, do you even use Facebook anyway? Aren't you too cool for Facebook?
I am definitely too cool for Facebook, but sometimes you have to stay in touch with your grandmother in India, right? So that is why
okay.
I use it. And I'm long emojis. I mean, we just need more emojis in our lives. I look forward to the day we can have an entire conversation with just emojis.
Yeah, it's bad for radio, though. All right, Trace, give me your long.
Lizzie, I am long something called the Rainbow Bagel.
Oh,
have you heard of the Rainbow Bagel?
I have heard of the Rainbow Bagel.
For weeks now, the local bagel store around the corner from my house, I have been walking by going, wow, people are really into bagels these days. And like that classic out of touch person, I had to read about it in the Wall Street Journal this week. It is actually the home of the Rainbow Bagel. The original home is around the corner from my apartment. And this is what all of the lines are about. People are freaking out about rainbow-colored bagels. I should describe them. They are actually technicolored, very bright bagels.
And they showed up on the TV show Broad City.
Broad City was on Colbert. The two girls from Broad City were on Colbert the other week. They brought rainbow bagels. He ate them. They said they tasted like lip gloss. I haven't actually tried these, but they've had the rainbow bagels in this bagel shop for quite a long time. I actually took a picture of it the other week and was like, ew, who would eat this? Like
everyone. Apparently everyone.
Everyone. So yeah. Rainbow bagels. It's a thing.
All right, Raghu, what are you short, man?
I am short on the European Union, much like a failing relationship. You can kind of
start
to see.
You are stealing my ideas.
I am
Go
stealing
ahead.
Your idea, but it was a good one. You know, last year with the Greek debt crisis, we saw Grexit. Now we're looking at a Brexit referendum later this year. There's rumors of a Frexit from France. I mean, eventually they got to blow this thing up, right?
Yeah, I mean, this week we saw the first border checks between France and Belgium in, I don't know how long, but a really long time. And I have to say, you know, when I was in Paris in December, I think people were really grumpy about the Eurozone in general and the sort of question of, like, who are we? Are we a single country? Are we a group of 28 countries? What are we, you know?
It's a great question.
Right, and if you look at polls for the referendum that's going to happen in June in the UK, whether or not they stay or go, they're pretty split.
Yeah.
You've got the prime minister campaigning to stay. You've got the mayor of London campaigning to leave. I mean, I don't know. I'm not willing to go long or short the European Union, but I think it's a really fascinating time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little more on Raghu's side here. I think I'm short the idea of the Eurozone.
Certainly, if you think about the European Union as a process of integration, what we've seen is definitely that process grind to a halt. Mm-hmm. So whether or not you actually start reversing and dismantling the European Union, I'm not, it's interesting. But certainly that period of integration has really slowed to stopped to possibly reverse
started
itself.
To reverse, yeah. And Tracy, what are you short?
All right, the Oscars are this weekend. I am short, I'm not short watching the Oscars. I am short watching the Oscars with Twitter, with my Twitter feed up and kind of constantly referring to Twitter to see what other people are saying or what kind of jokes other people are making. I've been doing that a lot for the debates, and I feel like people are so fast and so snarky, and while I do enjoy being a part of the online community, I have my own thoughts. I am going to close the internet, and I am going to think those thoughts on my and give myself the chance to think those thoughts without the peanut gallery weighing in.
Peanut gallery, what do you say?
Yeah, I actually am going to take the other side on this. I feel like I watch live events just so I can understand what's happening on my Twitter feed at this point.
But don't you feel like it limits your ability to actually think those things yourself?
Absolutely. I have no independent thought at this point, but I am okay with this. I just want to know what's funny and what people are making jokes about.
I mean, you did steal my thoughts on the European
Union.
There
you go. That's a true millennial. I'm just sharing at this point. I'm just a sharer. Social media sharing. It's the rage.
I will give that a ha-ha emoji.
Raghu Manavalan, Tracy Samuelson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lizzie.
There's a reason why we do the numbers on Marketplace shows so much. Numbers are a huge part of the economic and financial world. And every day, Marketplace's By the Numbers blog posts the numbers in the news on our website, marketplace.org. Here are producers Tony Wagner and Tobin Lowe with this week's news, By the Numbers. Tobin?
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
28.
That's the percentage of speaking parts in TV and movies over the past couple years that went to people of color.
USC analyzed 11,000 parts and released an analysis on Monday, just in time for the Oscars.
That's not all. Women held just a third of these roles, and LGBT people held just 2%.
$2.8 billion.
That's how many dollars John Deere's financial services wing made last year.
That accounts for a third of the machinery company's 2015 profits.
Since commodity prices have slid, John Deere's been relying on its loan and lease wing to stay in the black.
Or, you know, the green.
18,300.
NASA says that's how many people applied to be astronauts since it put out the call late last year.
That's more than double the previous record, but only about 14 at most will make it.
Did you apply, Tony?
You know, I wanted to, but glasses, can't do it.
Yeah, that's what's holding you back.
This week, the Obama administration gave out a half dozen low-cost loans to rural communities to encourage development. It's part of a push to go after rural poverty. Census data shows that non-metro areas have higher poverty rates than their metro counterparts. The administration is also wrapping in a package of policies and incentives to combat opioid addiction, which is on the rise nationally. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack is leading the effort, and I had a chance to talk with him. Mr. Secretary, welcome.
It's great to be with you.
There's a lot of stuff in this plan, and, you know, I look at meals, I look at expanded SNAP benefits, I look at telemedicine, the opioid crisis. What's the goal here?
Well, the goal, I think, is first and foremost to reduce the number of children who are living in homes that are at or below the poverty level, which means essentially increasing the number of good-paying jobs. And that's we've started that process, but there's more work to do. It's also making sure that the impact of poverty doesn't disproportionately disenfranchise these kids from a bright future. So that does involve the importance of access to early childhood education, making sure that they get proper nutrition at schools, making sure that they have quality educational opportunities, making sure that the healthcare is available should they have a problem, to basically reduce the impact and mitigate the impacts of poverty. So that is the reason why we are focused on this rural impact effort, where it's a two-generational approach, 10 communities around the country, where we're going to try to figure out what works in terms of helping mom and dad in terms of education and workforce training and getting them prepared for these new jobs that we're creating, and at the same time dealing with the impacts for the youngsters of living in a home that's struggling financially. And overarching all of that is the concern that we all have about the expanding opioid and heroin use in rural areas, which is going to further complicate a challenging circumstance.
Yeah, I mean, there have been a lot of headlines recently, a study that showed that death rates among white middle-aged Americans are rising. Is this an attempt to address that?
It is. When you deal with 47,000 Americans dying from substance abuse, poisoning, or suicides that are connected to heroin or opioid use, it's obviously something that we need to be very, very focused on. And it really will require a comprehensive approach. We're visiting with county officials, with governors, state and local officials to coordinate this approach. It involves, first and foremost, education and prevention, working with the medical community to reduce the prescribing of these drugs. We've seen a 300% increase in prescription drugs, painkillers. It is certainly a focus on making sure that if there is an abuse situation, an overdose situation, that we can respond to it with our first responders having the tools to be able to counteract the abuse and the overdose.
You mentioned first responders. Why not have the administration push to have Narcan, also known as naloxone, which can reverse a heroin overdose, be sold over the counter nationally?
Well, in fact, that's what we're currently making an effort to do. First and foremost, making sure that we increase the supply of that drug and making sure that it's used in a user-friendly manner. That's why we basically
would you like all first responders to carry it?
It would be great. This is really about expanding that tool to be able to deal with the consequence of overdose so that we can get people in a place where they can ultimately take advantage of medication-assisted treatment and eventually recover and have a brighter future.
How is handling opioid abuse in a rural community different from doing it in, say, New York or D.C.?
Well, it starts with the value system in rural communities of this notion of self-reliance and independence. It makes it very difficult. It's in small communities, sometimes you want to protect the sense of privacy. So it makes it a little bit difficult for people to admit that they've got a problem. And then the question is, are there going to be resources available to help people out of a tough situation? And frankly, a substantial amount of the shortages of mental health and substance abuse services in this country are in rural areas.
Your mother had drug and alcohol problems. How has that changed the way you approach this?
Well, I remember as a young person being very critical and judgmental of my mom, recognizing and feeling that somehow this was a character flaw on her part, not realizing what science tells us today, that there are physiological reasons for addiction, that this is no different in a way than cancer or any other physical ailment and needs to be treated and acknowledged as such. I think also the fact that my mom turned her life around, but did so with a great deal of help, not only professional help, but also AA meetings and being able to visit with people who had gone through similar circumstances, that may be missing in rural communities, which is why I think faith-based organizations in particular have a responsibility in small towns to open up the church basement or the community meeting center for the AA meeting, to work with parishioners and the congregations to understand and appreciate that we can't be judging these people as having faulty character or somehow poorer character, that we need to recognize they're a friend and neighbor and a family member and they need help and we need to be there to provide that help.
I look at the budget requests here and I know we're in the backdrop of you guys are asking for the FY17 budget. $25 billion of that is discretionary, and you'll probably fight me on this, but you're probably not going to get it all. So what is the most important thing for you? Where's the money really needed?
Well, the president's budget does include an additional $1 billion, which is not necessarily in my department, but is spread throughout several other departments, which would significantly increase the ability for us to help states and local communities locate those behavioral service centers in remote areas. I think that's extremely important. The ability to expand education and prevention information, the ability to work with communities. There are a lot of different ways in which that additional money can make a big difference. And we're advocating for it, even though it's not part of our budget, because at the end of the day, it affects the people that we have responsibility for, which is the folks who live, work, and raise their families in rural communities.
Secretary Vilsack, thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you.
This next story picks up where our interview with Secretary Vilsack left off. It's about the business of addiction recovery. One of the things we do here is take stories that you suggest and dig into them a little bit. We call it local money. And this week's story comes to us from Alexander Fermansky in Delray Beach, Florida, who wrote us about sober houses and halfway homes in that community. They are controversial, both because some people don't want them there and because others worry that vulnerable people recovering from addiction are being preyed on by scams. We got reporter Ann Gagas to talk us through this. She's with the Sun Sentinel newspaper, and she's written a lot about it. Welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
So I gather that this area in South Florida is called the Recovery Capital of America. How did that happen?
I think as the nation's substance abuse problems have gotten worse, you know, heroin deaths have nearly quadrupled from 2002 to 2013. A lot of businesses have figured out that South Florida is a very desirable place to sell rehabilitation. We have great beaches. We have great year-round weather. It never gets much below 65, and people complain bitterly when it does. And I'd say part of it is a classic Chamber of Commerce Florida pitch, is that we have great beaches, we have great weather, plenty of sunshine. Also, we have been ground zero for like the FLACA epidemic, the opioid epidemic. So it sort of makes sense that this would be the next thing.
What do you hear from residents who live there? You know, what are the various concerns that they're articulating?
I mean, it's something that people are on high alert for in all kinds of neighborhoods because they're worried about their property values and they don't want to see what they call the wrong element coming to their neighborhood.
And then I'd guess the flip side of this is that you could also say you have a very vulnerable population, you know, of recovering addicts, and who is looking out to make sure that these sober homes are providing the kind of facilities they advertise?
Absolutely. Some of them are charging, I've heard, $3,000 a week, you know, really high prices. And there's no way the government can really regulate it.
So what's the outlook? I know that in some of your stories, representatives, you know, of the state government have talked about this a bit, but what happens next?
I think they're going to try to get them to sort of self-register so there is some quality control. They'll be vying for sort of the equivalent of the Good Housekeeping seal. We've been looked at, you know, we are legitimate. Someone is looking over our practices. This is through the registry that the legislature has set up. There's about 2,250 dwellings that have registered statewide, but I've heard numbers that are 50,000 of these dwellings statewide.
Some of these services are really expensive. Who pays the bills for those? Are those individuals? Are insurance companies getting billed?
I understand that sometimes insurance companies are getting billed. I haven't, you know, investigated that aspect of it, but I've heard that some insurance companies do cover the cost of sober homes.
One of the headlines that was on one of your pieces was that sober homes and drug rehab centers become targets for critics and profiteers. What happens to somebody who is a profiteer, who's running one of these unscrupulously?
Well, the legislature has, in this session, is considering legislation that would try to crack down on practices like charging a lot of money for, you know, drug screening tests. We've heard crazy stories about how much residents have been charged for these different tests. And really, that's how the insurance companies are getting it. And also, supposedly, the cities are trying to find ways where they can at least monitor what's going on in their own neighborhoods, but it's going to be hard to zone this kind of thing. I really haven't seen a way that they can be zoned out of certain neighborhoods.
Ann Geggis from the Sun Sentinel in Florida, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Come tell us about the most important economic story where you live. Go to marketplace.org and click on Local Money. Feels like almost every month or so, there's a new announcement by a food company or retailer saying they're going to source their products differently. We've talked about that on this show before. Usually, it's with an eye to issues like animal welfare, sustainability, or non-genetically modified ingredients. Big shifts in consumer preferences are driving the changes, but crop and livestock producers are not all on board. Some feel like they aren't included in these conversations. Marketplace's Annie Baxter explains.
Reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
A few months ago, a bunch of people with ties to agriculture were gathered at a conference in Minneapolis. They were talking about making food production more sustainable.
Let's find out how he's going to do that and welcome John.
John Church, an executive at General Mills, was trumpeting his company's push to reduce greenhouse gas emissions throughout its supply chain, from its dairy producers on up. He said consumer demand was driving a lot of the changes.
We had to have intention because our consumers needed us to go there. Because our employees needed us to go there.
Big food execs like Church seem to actually welcome consumers' influence on their operations. But a number of people in the room seem to feel otherwise. Like this fellow, David Shem, from the National Association of Wheat Growers. He complained consumers' concerns were too faddish to be taken so seriously.
Many of them can change their opinion five times in one conversation. I don't change my cropping practice five times in one year.
This tension over who knows best, the consumer or the farmer, kept coming up. And at one point later in the conference, during a session I couldn't record, an audience member got a little confrontational. It was following a panel of speakers from several big food companies.
Well, I think the comment that I made was that, you know, we've got an awful lot of these food companies, food processors or whatever, that seem to be very quick to throw the producer under the bus, if you will.
Bob Young is senior economist at the American Farm Bureau Federation. He says food processors and retailers are issuing a lot of edicts these days about how farmers need to raise their livestock or grow their crops differently, often citing consumer concerns about things like sustainability or animal welfare. But he says farmers aren't always asked if the changes are practical.
We're going to change how we're going to ask you to farm, and we're not really going to ask you whether or not you can or you can't, either from a physical standpoint or from a fiscal standpoint, you know. Can you do it actually in the real world, and can you afford to pay for it? We don't really care. We're just going to demand that you do it.
Young's complaints strike a chord with Randy Sprunk. He's a hog farmer in Minnesota.
Thrown under the bus, that's the feeling that you get once in a while.
Sprunk says it's not just that farmers feel left out of the conversation, but they're also getting really confusing signals about what they're supposed to do differently.
Retailer A wants a sow that's in a pen. Retailer B wants one antibiotic-free. Retailer C wants the sow to be outside. Which one do I listen to? I only got one pig.
Sprunk actually has nearly 100,000 pigs. But when he says he's only got one, he means he only raises them one way. He then markets them to several different meat packers, who in turn sell parts like the ham, the loin, or the bacon to a whole bunch of domestic and international food service and retail end markets. If one food retailer wants bacon from pigs who've never touched GMO feed, the whole pig has to be raised that way, even if the other retailers don't care about the GMO thing.
I can't do it just to their particular cut that they need. I need it to do it to the entire pig. So then it becomes the rest of the pig, who's going to pay for the higher cost?
Adding to the frustration among farmers is the sense that some of the prescriptions to do things differently strike them as unnecessary. They think they're already following best practices.
The first thing I hear from producers, from growers, is, I'm already sustainable. Why do I need to do this? And my reply back is, I don't necessarily disagree with you, but we need your data to prove it.
Stephanie Millie Grant is with Unilever Corporation. She's also chair of the board of Field to Market. It's an organization that helps farmers do things like use less water or fertilizer. Grant says highlighting the economic benefits along with the environmental ones can help mitigate farmers' frustrations.
Absolutely, especially if you can tie it to economics and the bottom line. If you can show it by doing this, you're actually going to save money or your yields will increase, things like that, that absolutely helps.
But Randy Sprunk, the hog farmer, says the financial benefits of changing his ways aren't clear to him yet.
And so, quite frankly, until the marketplace wants to incentivize me or send a clear signal, I'm going to sit on my hands, continue to raise the pigs as my father and grandfather did.
In other words, he needs to be paid enough to change how he does business. He says so far, that's not happening. In St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
No matter who you are, you probably had a first job that changed you, or you learned a lifelong financial lesson somewhere unexpected. We like to ask all sorts of notable people about how money played a role in their lives. It's called the Marketplace Quiz, and here again is Marketplace producer Raghu Manavalan with this week's guest.
Hi, I'm Samantha Bee. I host the show Full Frontal on TBS Mondays at 10:30.
In a next life, what would your career be?
In my next life, my career would probably be something in the world of food. I could theoretically see myself as a very artisanal farmer that really like plows by hand. I'm not even kidding. Or a chef or someone who runs a restaurant, actually, a small restaurant, a breakfast restaurant. I cook all the time. I cook all the time. It's really important to me. I shop for ingredients. It's very inconvenient. It's one of the most inconvenient things that can be your hobby because I work a lot. So it's really hard to make time. It's hard to carve out time to get the good eggs at the farmer's market, but I do it. I'm exhausted. I'm exhausted.
I guess this leads me to my next question. What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows?
Oh, that's a great question. There's just a lot of kind of technical minutiae around doing this job, or at least around building a show up from zero. You know, you have to make the business cards and you have to figure out who's sitting where in your office. There are kind of technical considerations. You have to build a set from scratch. I mean, it's not like we didn't work with someone. We absolutely did. But there's a lot of sort of decision making about things like color schemes and materials that go into the building of your set. And that's not really my world. So I actually was very challenged by having to make split-second decisions about things that would make the physical makeup of the show over time that I'd have to live with for a really long time.
What is something you bought that you now completely regret buying?
I don't really regret anything that I've bought in recent memory. I do regret selling my house in Canada. We sold our house in Canada in 2006 or something like that, because it was obvious we weren't going to live in it anymore. But I feel like we should have held on to it because, you know, I could have put a parent in it or something like that. It was a great house. And so now when I go back to Toronto and I visit my family, sometimes I do a drive-by. I drive slowly up the street to see if they changed the did the paint or, you know, if they did anything to the deck. I completely regret selling my house in Canada.
What is your most prized possession?
We have one thing, which is a chandelier. We have a beautiful kind of wire chandelier with metal birds on it from France that my husband bought for us when we bought a house in Toronto and we were so broke and it was so expensive. And he bought it because we loved it so much and it was an amazing, and of course we still have it. We'll have it forever. It's really beautiful and I love it. But I do, when I really think about it, I think about who we were at that time and how much of a stretch it was for him to buy that for me.
When did you realize your current career could be an actual paying career?
I only realized that when I got hired to do it. I was working at an advertising agency at the time when I got hired by The Daily Show, so they rescued me from the real world. And that was probably the first time I went, oh, I could probably do this for a while. This could be sustained as long as they don't fire me. And then they didn't.
What is something everyone should own no matter the cost?
What is something that everyone should own no matter the cost? Well, I'm going to make this a specific woman thing. Sorry. Every woman should own a good bra, no matter how much it costs. Even if you need to get that bra custom made, you should have a bra that fits you. It's so important. It's essential for happiness.
What advice do you wish someone gave you before you started your career?
Well, I think people gave me a lot of advice before I started my career, and I think a lot of that advice was don't do that career. That's a terrible idea. So mostly people's advice. Thank goodness I didn't take it.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, and maybe on the weekend you get some sun. You probably don't know how much, though, which is what this next story is about. A wearable skin patch and an app that helps you monitor sun exposure when you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
We are just outside the L'Oreal building, and we're going to go inside to learn about, what would we call this, the first generation of cosmetic wearables?
Yeah, sure. We could call it that. I think it's part of a new kind of wearable that presumably is going to be less expensive than your average $100 wearable device and maybe a little bit more disposable, but it'll also deliver information both to the user about their skincare, but also to the company that makes it, which will then, I think, be turning that data into recommendations for the wearer of the wearable when it comes to cosmetics.
All right, let's go inside.
Cool.
I'm Geev Baluch. I'm the Global Vice President of our Technology Incubator in Research and Innovation at L'Oreal.
So I was looking at your hands when we met, and you have two interesting looking patches on your hands. They're both heart shaped. Lizzie,
what are those, man?
So it's actually our new innovation. It's called the MyUV patch. This is a technology that it looks like, you know, a kind of a transfer sticker or a second skin, and inside you have electronics, and this is an actual wearable that can be on the skin and act like a second skin, so you can wrinkle the skin. And
how does it work?
Okay, so you have the electronics inside. When you scan the patch, it will then go to the application and take a photo of this heart. You have 16 squares in this heart, and each of half of these squares are changing colors at different intensities. So let's say you're out in the sun for 20 minutes without SPF. One of these squares will turn from dark blue to white. The other ones will take more time. So you can wear the patch up to 5 days. Mm. And after 5 days, every time you take a scan, it will let you know how much exposure you've had. It will give you tips on what to do with your lifestyle and let you know, if there's certain periods in the day that you're really exposed to UVA and UVB, things that, you know, are not very intuitive because you're just running around all day as a consumer. And the key is that the more you scan the patch, the more information you'll get.
Can we try it?
Sure, of course.
Can we put one on me?
Yeah, so I'll put one on you.
Okay, let's do it.
So I'm opening the packaging right now.
We got like a little silver package.
Yes.
With a heart.
It's very pretty.
Yes. And it's silver because you want to make sure that no UV gets through the actual packaging. Oh. So there's a reason for that.
Okay.
And then what you'll see here is that I'm peeling back the actual electronic itself. And when I peel it, you'll actually see a really thin near-field communication. So this gold kind of outline is the actual near-field communication technology.
So that's sort of all the hardware, if you will.
Exactly.
Inside. All right. So we've got our little blue hearts on.
Right.
Then what happens?
So, this app says at risk on it. I'm already scared.
When you scan the patch, what will happen is that you will put your Android, if you have near field communication, it will just, you put it right next to the patch and it will activate the app. If you have an iPhone, you just open the application. It'll take a picture of the heart. And once you have that photo, you have two metrics that you have. The left side is, at that moment, how much risk do I have? So it's a little dial that goes from green to orange to red, and it will let you know if you're at a low, medium, or high risk. Mm-hmm. And then on the right-hand side, you have what we're calling the daily sun intake. So what that means is that every morning, you wake up with a full heart. And this heart, as you're exposed to more and more UV, will start to go lower and lower. And every morning you wake up, it will go back to a full heart. So there's kind of this way we want consumers to understand the level of exposure that they have during the day and that they can correct it. They can make their behavior better. The next morning, you know, I want to keep my heart more and more full. So there's a positive kind of link to that. And we will give you the information along the day, how much actual exposure you've had and when you applied the sunscreen so that you can know at what periods of the day you're at the most risk.
So you plan on bringing it to market for free. When does it become available to consumers? And nobody gives anything away for free. So what do you get out of it?
Yeah, so it's going to be at the second half of the year. We're aiming, obviously, for the summer season. We are not planning to charge a service for this for the consumer for this. And I think you're right to say that, you know, in the end, how will this drive business? And the answer is that we feel that if you can educate consumers and you can give them the right information, that they will use our products. And we really believe, and I think L'Oreal in general, we really believe that we want to bring technology to the consumer to empower their choices rather than trying to immediately just make money off of the technology itself.
But you're playing with the data, right? I mean, you have to be to all the data that's being collected, and not in a Big Brother way, but collected through the app and the app's use has to be informative for you when you think about how to make product for the consumer.
Absolutely. So the way we approach data is that we're not collecting any consumer personal data. So we don't
collect
that.
So it's anonymized.
It's totally anonymized. However, as you said, even with anonymous data, you could get some interesting learnings. But that's more in the research and development side to see how we can innovate new products for the future. So there is a benefit for us, obviously, in that. But it's not personal data. It's just anonymized data that we'll start to learn more about UV exposure around the world.
A lot of work went into this for developing something that you're going to give away. What leapfrogs on the back of this technology? What's the next thing that's similar?
Well, you know, within our industry, the first step is we want to bring a revolution in terms of how much education people have in terms of UV. The more that the consumer electronic industry starts to kind of open and near-field communication, the more you have this kind of innovation in tech, the more ability you'll have to reach more and more people. And you can imagine all kinds of new sensors you can put into it. You can imagine different things you can measure on the skin. And when you think about wearable technology today, this is an example of where you're truly a wearable because you can put it anywhere on the body. And that is a new kind of concept in the consumer electronics industry. And I think when you think about that, there are implications about what you can measure in the future. Think about anything you're concerned about your skin, and you can think of many things you could measure with it.
Keith Ballage, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for putting a heart on our hands.
You're totally welcome. Thank you.
You can see pictures of the patch at our website, marketplace.org. Now we're going to move from tech in the U.S. to tech overseas. India, which has about 1.3 billion people, could have 500 million internet users by next year, 400 million of them getting online via mobile phones. That's a huge business opportunity for companies that make mobile content. And both Indian and Western media companies are trying to figure out on how to get in on what could be the world's largest entertainment revolution. The BBC's Rahul Tandon has this story from Mumbai.
When you think of cinema in India, you think of Yash Raj films and songs and dancing and weddings. But now, they're producing a different type of content. That is India's first transgender pop group, the Six Pack Band, launched by the company on YouTube. Ashish Patil is the man in charge of Y Films, which is looking to provide content to India's young audience.
It's amazing how everyone at every data point in terms of economic strata has access. They may not have access to shoes, but they will have access to a mobile phone. People have just reprioritized life. That includes your house help, that includes your security guard, the works. And internet penetration is just exploding. At the top of the pyramid are the guys who use smartphones and consume a lot of data. That still is a sizable number, which is 50 million plus. And given the fact that this is the world's youngest country, with about 70% of a population sitting below the age of 30, 35, that audience sitting on the web is even younger. And these are people who do not have the patience to watch stuff at an appointed hour.
And that 50 million you talk about, that could be 250 million in a few years' time.
Yeah, sooner than we think. Sooner than we think.
I dream of a digital India where high-speed digital highways unite the nation. I dream.
That's the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who's promised to bring the internet to every single part of this country. There is a long way to go, and even in cities like Mumbai, connectivity can be an issue. But let's get off these busy streets and get into an office full of young people and ask them, how are they consuming their content nowadays?
So I think that like TV and cinema and everything, is all of that is traditional media and it's never going to die. But this generation, our generation that is, consumes a lot of content digitally, like mostly on our phones, on our tabs. Everybody wants to create content for the web because most people are like taking content from the web.
Digital actually makes sure that the content is provided on the device that you use the most, which is your mobile.
If I'm traveling for work, I can just watch anything on my phone. If I'm just lying down on my bed and I don't want to just carry my laptop around, I can just watch anything on my phone. That is number one priority for me, and it should be available on the phone.
It took Netflix 18 years to debut in India.
Isse kam time mein to IRCTC pe ticket bhi book ho
jata. The launch of Netflix has caused a lot of excitement amongst content producers here. Prakash Jhaa is one of this country's best-known film directors. He says it's all part of India's entertainment revolution.
Netflix has already come in, and they are preparing content for now Netflix, and there's a whole lot which is happening in terms of internet, and people will be able to have entertainment through internet and use television or big projection screens in their houses to, you know, see films at their will.
So expect to see a new generation of musicians and actors coming from the internet, because in a country of 1.2 billion people, as connectivity increases, 10 million hits is going to be easy to get.
That story comes to us from our partners at the BBC. And that's our show for this week. Next week, your stories of financial recovery. Want to share yours? Visit marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. And yes, your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Madhavalan and Haley Hirschman. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Chris Clark is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.